Welcome to Where is the Imposter? I'm Lucy Thomas and I'm a third year politics and international relations student at the London School of Economics. As someone who has often felt like an imposter and continues to feel like an imposter at times, I'm interested in finding out how common imposter syndrome actually is. I will be talking to people from within a variety of occupations, as well as students that do different degrees from different universities, aiming to expose the prevalence of imposter syndrome and how we may work to overcome it. If you've ever felt like a fraud or like you don't belong, or even if you want to prevent this from happening in the near future, this podcast is for you. Thank you very much for listening. Today we are joined with Shauna Davis, and she actually did her Bachelor of Laws at University College London and a Law, Environment and Economics Masters at Cambridge, graduating with a first class from both. And she's now a barrister at Number 5 Barristers Chambers. And I had a look kind of like what you're working in, like planning, infrastructure, environmental law. First of all, I just want to ask you how you are. And I might as well add as well, is that me and Shauna both went to the same secondary school in Bilth.
We did.
Bilth Wells, we Rural did. Mid Wales.
We did.
How we know each other. But yeah, Shauna, how are you?
Yeah, really well. Thanks, Lucy. Had a lovely Christmas back in very snowy mid Wales, but it's good to be back in London now.
Oh, good. I'm glad. I can't wait to come back, actually. I'm very excited. First of all, I was just going to ask you about kind of your university years before I delve into what you're doing now. So I know that you were in King's College, London for a year before you went to UCL to do law. Obviously, that's quite a huge change. I mean, you're jumping from one field to one, you know, very different field. And I was just wondering, you know, what kind of made you make that decision to go into law instead of what you were doing previously? Because I know that you used to study kind of something sciencey, if I remember correctly. What kind of made you make that decision, just first of all?
Yes, okay. So, yeah, I did 1 year. So I'll start again. So,
don't worry, I edit
those. Obviously, we both went to secondary school in Mid Wales, and I always thought I wanted to go and study law. So it may sound counterintuitive, but my initial application was for law at several really good universities, none of which were in London. I think London was a big bad place that scared the living daylights out of me at the time. Mm-hmm. But I did apply to Oxford. So that was my initial UCAS application. I later decided through the course of my A-level years, because I was doing several A-levels in sciences, that I might give science a go at university, particularly given that I was encouraged to do so by lots of my teachers. They said, oh, you're doing well at, you know, biology and maths, and you should really think seriously about doing a first year in sciences. So I followed their advice and went through UCAS extra at the time and managed to secure a place at King's College London. And within the first term, I decided really that I'd made a big mistake and that it wasn't for me. Nothing to do with the course or the university. It's obviously a really great school and a really great program, but I just decided that I wasn't really doing the right thing and that I ought to have reverted to plan A. So I then went on to study law at UCL and, like you say, did a master's and then bar school at Cambridge and back in London respectively. But yes, it was a very big change from Mid Wales, as you and I are both from farms, Lucy. We should know that it's probably the biggest change if you're staying on in the UK, that is.
Definitely.
Yeah, going from rural Mid Wales and a relatively small high school to big bad London was quite a change, but a really, 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 really good one, and one I probably wouldn't have embraced without encouragement from teachers and other people who were much older than me in school who I'd seen make the transition from Mid Wales to London. It was really, really good to reach out to some of those people who were able to really give me the push and tell me that this was the right thing to be doing.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think a lot of people, when you mentioned about London, a lot of people, when they know I'm in London now, they always say to me, oh, I could never live in London. You know, I don't know how you do it. But yeah, that's really interesting. And I was just going to ask then, like, you obviously changed your mind because you knew in your heart that what you were doing clearly wasn't the right path for you. How do you kind of differentiate them? Because I think a lot of people, I mean, me specifically as well, when I started my course, I was like, I'm really enjoying this, but I feel like I, you know, don't deserve to be here. How do you kind of differentiate between these feelings of self-doubt, which is quite often irrational, and the feeling of actually knowing that what you're doing is genuinely not the right thing for you and that you'd rather be doing something else?
I think it's a particularly tricky question when I would really class myself as someone who liked most subjects in school, to be honest. There wasn't really any subject that I particularly hated. But equally, like, I wasn't, you know, the smartest at maths or the smartest at English either. Like, I was somewhere in the middle. I really genuinely enjoyed everything. And for some reason, law does seem to attract that type of person quite often. So it attracts people who are often academically interested in lots of different areas and have many different skills. Going back to your initial question, which was, how do you stop these feelings of self-doubt creeping in where perhaps you don't feel comfortable doing a given subject? I think it's hard, and it's hard in every discipline in university, and many of my friends struggled with the same problem, given that I think when you're at school, you know, you're forced to grapple with so many different subjects. And like I say, I did A-levels across a wide variety of subjects, to then be thrown into a highly specialist environment with practitioners who are at the top of their field, lecturers, academics, students who are living and breathing the subject 5 days or so, 7 days a week, I should say, for many, many hours of the day, and working on research again at the top of their field. And I think often you will find that unless you've been the type of student who's really committed to one discipline, you know, be that sciences or humanities or social sciences at school, then you will often find that you are suddenly dealing with a depth of subject knowledge and matter and people who are really, really specialists. Where you perhaps haven't encountered that before, and that can be really daunting. It can make you feel not smart enough. But what I think you have to realise is that, firstly, most people come to university with that feeling, and though many people won't admit it, lots of people do struggle with those feelings. And secondly, you know, we all come from different curriculums, different educational systems, different ways of teaching. And whilst someone might say that they know, you know, an awful lot about one particular type of subject area, they might know absolutely nothing about another, but often they'll only talk about the bits that they know an awful lot about. It could be a sort of there could be a misalignment, I guess, between what you think everyone knows and what people actually know when they come to university, particularly if you study at, you know, really challenging institutions like LSE. Then you really have to get used to the fact that you won't be the smartest person in the room, and that's often comes with a change of mindset from what you may have felt at school, where you might have felt really comfortable with answering every question in class, being the person that puts their hand up and answers everything the teacher asks you, and always knowing the answer, to going to university, where all of a sudden, firstly, you don't know the answer to everything because you're dealing with, like I say, specialists with a real depth of knowledge in their subject area who are lecturing on their favourite topic often. And revision books and papers about it. Yeah, and secondly, with people who are as fascinated and love the subject as much as you do. And, you know, that requires a change in mindset. And I think the only way really to overcome that is to just embrace it. And it really took me a long, long time to just embrace it and to think, I am honoured to be in the class with people who are, you know, smarter than me and are able to answer all of the questions with real confidence and ability. I think it just requires being able to kind of embrace that rather than shy away from it or be scared about it.
Yeah, I agree. I completely agree. And I think in the last interview I did, it was literally someone who I knew from school, but he talked about how we need to kind of reclaim what imposter syndrome is, because feeling like an imposter is not always a bad thing. Like, sometimes it can kind of, I mean, if you never feel like an imposter in your life, then you're probably living a too comfortable life. Like, it's
right.
So obviously sometimes it can make you just feel awful about yourself, but in some ways, I suppose, if you want to look at it in a more positive light, you can use it to kind of push yourself to try and get on that same level as some people, and push yourself to kind of take more interest in things that you think to yourself, oh, I don't know enough about that. So, you know, when you arrived in UCL and when you arrived in Cambridge, you know, was there ever kind of, you know, any particular moments that you think about and you think, oh gosh, I really feel like an imposter right now? Was there anything you told yourself to overcome any particular feelings of imposter syndrome?
I remember being the first term is frightening, isn't it? The just the way in which you suddenly have to adapt, and it's a big step. It's a big learning curve. I think it was probably I'd say there's been a gradual acceptance of the feeling over time. So I wouldn't say it's necessarily gone away. I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say that it ever goes away, to be honest, and I can come on to talk about that in more detail later when we talk about what I do now, but I think it's a feeling that you sort of learn to live with and you learn to cope with, and you have to, like you say, learn to adapt and realise that it's actually a really positive thing that you're surrounding yourself with such challenging and interested people.
Thinking about that then, what would you kind of say to anyone who's thinking to themselves that they want to apply to a top university, but they're also thinking to themselves, I'm probably not good enough, I probably won't get in, should I just play it safe?
So I think you firstly got to look at, how much you've achieved. If you're even thinking about applying to top universities, you've obviously got good grades, you'll have good teacher references, you'll have people who are willing to support an application to the top university. And that is awesome, and you have to realize that you've achieved a lot of that without perhaps some of the support that others may have had, which is amazing. And if you looked at two people like for like with the same grade, the fact that you've been able to achieve a lot of those things without some of the deep support networks that other people have is amazing and a big tick. And that's obviously something you should really grasp with two hands and think seriously about applying to the best universities.
I was just going to move on then to what you're doing right now, which is working as a barrister. But first, would you mind explaining what the difference is between a barrister and a solicitor is? And also, would you mind explaining what a pupillage is and how they are necessary to becoming a barrister?
So the difference between a solicitor and a barrister, traditionally, obviously, barristers do more court-based advocacy or tribunal work. Solicitors do more kind of client-facing work and have a longer relationship with the client typically than a barrister, who often picks up a file and takes it to a hearing or advises on a particularly contentious part of a case and then hands it back to a solicitor. That's a very kind of crude distinction between the two. It's not always like that. Like I say, barristers can be involved for a very long period of time, and often a lot of the advisory work doesn't involve going to court, but just generally speaking, that's the difference. So to become a solicitor, you have to undergo training with a law firm. So to become a barrister, you have to undergo training with a set of chambers, or there are ways of training with to be an employed barrister, but I won't go into that today. But yeah, you do have to get a pupillage to train to be a self-employed barrister, which is effectively a year-long a period of training with a set of chambers who will take you under their wing and give you all the tools and equipment that you need in order to start out life as a baby barrister. So that involves 6 months of shadowing your supervisors and 6 months where you continue to shadow your supervisors but also take some on some of your own work. And the precursor to PUP is a training course at a university normally, where you pick up to feed into the pupillage year. So learning how to move in court, cross-examine witnesses.
From what I've heard, it's rather sometimes after a pupillage, are they able to just kind of say to you, oh, we're not really that anymore? This kind of fear of, am I going to land it? Is there a sense of the most the brightest minds, essentially? I suppose, is there any sense of that?
So I think that's true across the solicitor training program and the barrister's training program. So at the end of a solicitor's training program, you basically, there's a decision on whether you become a solicitor at the firm or not, or you can move elsewhere after that period. And similarly with a barrister's training, there's a period at the end of your pupillage where the decision is you can join the set of chambers and become what's known as a tenant. So a tenant because most people at the self-employed bar are self-employed. The employed bars are very different, but you, by becoming a self-employed barrister, are required to pay into the chamber's pot, as it were, a monthly fee for clerking services, overhead, such as the premises from which you work, professional legal subscriptions, you know, people who chase up your accounts and market you to the wider solicitor network. So being intense food by lots of different people. You know, your work is really, really carefully checked. It's looked at, your ability to persuade a court is scrutinised. You're really under the microscope for a year, and that is a really intense feeling, and can be quite daunting when you start out, particularly given that you're interacting with, like you say, very senior people from the outset. So yeah, it's very, very difficult not to feel like you have imposter syndrome, to be honest with you. But from like what I understand, it's a feeling that doesn't really go away either. So law is very hierarchical. It tries not to be in many ways, but and I wouldn't say that's necessarily true with my current set of chambers, which I really think tries hard to have that hierarchical nature. But it is true that the person that comes with it can make it feel like there is, that can lead to you feeling, feeling like you're perhaps not good enough at times, which is often misplaced, but a misplaced feeling. But that's a feeling, I would say, that's endemic. It's common among many, many people I speak to.
Yeah. So, yeah, I was going to say, because now you're obviously a barrister, considering your working environment. From what I've heard about this sort of working environment is that it's very much dominated by, you know, people who obviously attended private schools, and then lots of people have come from Oxbridge, have first class degree, you know, they're almost as if they were kind of groomed for Oxbridge and groomed for having jobs in the establishment. And I was just thinking, you know, what is it like environment, and do you think we need to sort of, I suppose, change this profession in a way to enable more diversity and allow more people to come in from different backgrounds? Because watching people I know like apply for these kind of jobs and think a career in these kind of jobs, when they look through like the current, you know, barristers, and they kind of look at what they've done, it's like, oh my gosh, you know, they've done everything, they've got so many prizes, they've come from like the best schools, the best universities. And I can imagine, I mean, you've done extremely well though, so you know, you obviously went to UCL and Cambridge, but is it, you know,
it is, often see threads of people on Twitter and LinkedIn who are frightened and daunted by the prospect of CVs of people, because I suppose rather uniquely at the bar, your individual CV is published online, so people can see where you went to university and what classification of degree you had, whereas that's not some other professions. And I think, you know, that means that people are on it more than they should. There is much being done to change it though. It's difficult when you've got a pool of very a very competitive, very an excellent pool of people who apply for pupillage every year. They are normally extremely well qualified, and it is difficult to shake off that feeling of inferiority, if you like. But everyone has something different to bring to the table, and ultimately we are human beings dealing with really human problems. You know, one of my friends is a family barrister, and she deals day to day with decisions on, you know, whether children should be taken away from their parents and whether that's in their best interest. She deals with how divorce money should be split up and whether the children should spend 50% of their week with mum or 70% of their week with mum, or, you know, the remainder of their week with dad. So just, they're very human problems. That's not really an academic issue, you know, you're dealing with. That's a very real world problem. Plainly, there are areas of the bar where you are dealing with issues which are perhaps, you know, you're looking at trusts from a long time ago, or not areas of law that I deal with. Again, my area is more dealing with, you know, should this area be earmarked for development or not? You know, should a building go here? And that's a real world problem which requires real world people to solve. And ultimately, I think people with a diverse range of backgrounds can really bring added interests, dimensions, perspectives, opinions to those problems. And I think that's a really, really great asset that chambers should be looking to celebrate. And increasingly they are. So lots of chambers are moving towards looking at taking away things like names, universities, grade classifications, and looking more at competencies for how questions are answered, performance in interview, rather than looking at, you know, which school you went to and which university college you went to. Yeah. As I think people are realizing it's less and less relevant in a really kind of competitive marketplace with people.
That's really hopeful to hear, because I think
perhaps wishful thinking.
No, yeah, I know, but like I suppose it is going in the right direction, and it's nice to hear. It's nice to hear that, because it sounds very scary. Like I'm not going to bother people to want to do it. So it's nice to hear, but I was also just going to ask about this, because obviously, like, if you're a barrister, on the one hand, you not only have to be extremely good at writing, be a very eloquent speaker, I can imagine. And I suppose, do accents play quite a large role here? And I think when we watch kind of classic, British courtroom dramas, I'm going to talk about, I mentioned to you earlier, Anatomy of a Scandal is really good. I don't know how accurate it is, but it is really good. But like the barristers in that, they have a really, typically British accent that I suppose you always see in films that kind of often, I mean, most, this is going on a tangent, but most like British Oscar winners went to private school and are very well and sound quite posh. How does this kind of work within your profession? I mean, do you think that most people do kind of have this kind of public speaking background, and they do also sound like they come from, the best kind of schools in the UK? And how does that, I suppose, contribute to imposter syndrome for people who haven't come from that background and perhaps don't have as much experience with public speaking? And how would you respond to that?
Yeah, it is difficult. Lots of people do speak with a Queen's English, and it is quite difficult to deal with the fact that you sound different to lots of people. And that is something, again, something you're going to have to face, something you have to deal with. And my take on it is ultimately celebrate, because going back to what I was saying earlier, lots of people instruct barristers because they think they'll do the best job, obviously. But increasingly, I think people are looking to instruct barristers who they firstly get on really well with. They want normal people, people they spend a lot of time with, seeking advice from. And I don't think accent really plays a part in firstly how good your advice is, and secondly, how well you can necessarily articulate a point. But you're right, it is difficult to shake that feeling off when there is a dominance of 1% at the bar, in my experience at least. But again, going back to what I was saying earlier about, the work that my friend does with, often really difficult family law situations where she's dealing with people who are dealing with difficult problems with children, it's really important that she's able to level with those people and not seem like an other, not like seem like someone otherworldly, someone who's come from London and is going to, going to deal with some of the most important issues that they may ever have to face in their life. So I think differences in accents should be celebrated. But my colleague actually in Chambers, Hashim Mohammed, has written a really, really interesting book on this subject called People Like Us. And he had a difficult upbringing, and he writes a lot about diversity, accents, the ways that people dress and act in the legal profession. So I would recommend.
But like,
I did that too.
Yeah. And then I can imagine that, like, I mean, you'd notice it yourself, wouldn't you? Like, oh, I've got like the only like kind of Welsh accent here, everyone just sounds not like me. But yeah, that's it's nice to hear. And I think it is refreshing to think that I won't hold you for much longer. I was just gonna say kind of more generally, well, more specifically, what would you say to someone who wants to become a barrister, and how to kind of push through any feelings of imposter syndrome they have? And also kind of more generally, I mean, we have touched upon this quite a lot, but just to sort of finish off, what more generally, what would you say to, I suppose, anyone who feels like they're an imposter? Because, regardless of their kind of career, profession or university, what would you say to them if they're going through these feelings?
Okay, so two questions there, really. So the first, I would say work hard. There's no getting away from the fact that it's really hard work. And I think that's, I would say that people pride hard work more than, you know, the school that you came from, the where you went to university, you know, having, showing good stead, stand you in really good stead. Cut that bit loose. Yeah. Yes, I think that can stand you in really good stead for a career at the bar. I think look at broadening your CV. So really try and, you know, broaden your CV either through part-time work, student societies, sports clubs, all the things that give you an added experience and that challenge you, that push you, that give you more experiences that you can draw on in your CV. I think those are the two kind of key areas I would advise if you want to be a barrister. And obviously, just go for it. I think that's the main thing. And you're never going to be in the mix. You're never going to make it unless you try. So I think be willing to try is the kind of third main piece of advice I would give. On the second question, more broadly, dealing with issues of imposter syndrome, I think the reality is that if you've been selected to be on the programme that you're on, if you've been selected to the, you know, to LSE or any other top institution.
Like, oh, yeah, this isn't real, like, it can't be. But yeah,
it can't be. Yeah, so someone saw something in your grades or in your CV or in the answers to the questions on UCAS or any other application form that said to them that you had something to give. And it might not be the same experience as 90% of other people in the room, but you've obviously got something different, something brilliant to be able to share with the rest of the class. And I think that's something that's really important and you should celebrate it. Without celebrating it, you'll never realise that the difference is actually really, really powerful. And I think, yeah, increasingly organisations are celebrating difference and diversity. So just making sure that you sing about it, I think, is the main thing. But you're right, it's dealing with imposter syndrome is really, really difficult. But I think you need to realise that lots of people have imposter syndrome. Many, many, many people have imposter syndrome. I'm sure you found that at LSE too, Lucy. Like, yeah. And you just speak to even your classmates. Often, many people don't feel good enough to be there. But yeah, when you get to the end of your experience at LSE, you'll look back on it and you'll think, whoa, I did that. And like, I ended up with this grade or that grade. And, you know, I survived 3 years and that was a really, really big deal. And you can take that experience and take it into the next challenge, because inevitably you'll join the workplace and imposter syndrome there. So I think, again, learning to deal with it is really important. And like I say, celebrate the fact that you're different and just take solace in the fact that you're plainly good enough to be there.
Yeah, that's perfect. Well, thank you so much, Seanad. And thank no problem. You for agreeing to have me interview you.
Because
you're
thanks
one of
for
the
having
first
me.
People. Yeah, well, you're one of the first people I thought of when I decided to start this podcast. Thank you so much for listening to this interview. Hope you enjoyed it. And if you did, please join me for the next interview with Fionn Price, a previous student at the Italia Conti Academy of Theatre Arts in London. Thank you.